Sebastian Barry is the Dublin-born playwright, poet and novelist. His books include the Booker-nominated A Long, Long Way and On Canaan's Side and the Costa Award-winning The Secret Scripture, which was also Booker-nominated. His latest novel, The Temporary Gentleman, centres on a retired Irish soldier in 1950s Ghana as he recalls his life with his beloved wife, May. Sebastian Barry is with me now. People might already think, beloved wife May, I've heard of her before once or twice.
Absolutely.
And if I say that the gentleman, this Irish soldier's name is Jack McNulty, they will know these people. Who are they?
They'll know them in certain guises. And as I conceived of them at certain times in my writing life, which is now 35 years. If only I could say I've been alive for 35 years and would be in good shape. The first thing I did when I came out of Trinity in 1977 was go to Paris, and I wrote six stories about my grandfather, Jack, and myself knocking around. And it wasn't that long after we actually had been doing that. And then a couple of years later, I wrote a little novella about him and his wife, May, that was mostly composed of the stories, the rather terrifying and possibly fairy tale-esque stories my mother had told us when we were small about them, because it was pretty ferocious stuff.
Now, why do you think they were fairy tale-esque?
Because, I mean, at the time, as a little boy, everything is a fairy tale, I suppose. Everything you hear is augmented by the wonderful engine that's in a child. Everything is amplified. So I probably added fuel to it as well myself. But I think it was only clear to me in the last few years that my mother was, you know, a great embellisher of stories.
Your mother was the actress, Joan O'Hara, and well capable of telling a story.
And that was her business in life. I mean, that's what she did on stage. She brought an extra fire to the roles she was playing. So she put an extra few strokes into anything she was telling. And then the next time she'd tell it, which would be quite soon after, would there be some more. And indeed, there were the same stories repeated over and over again for all the years I knew her. And they were always shifting and changing. And I think even when she had the anecdote fresh, it was not quite what had happened. But that's the nature of human beings. And I suppose that informed Roseanne McNulty's attempt to write her own life in The Secret Scripture. It's obvious from the account of Dr. Green and from the account of Father Gaunt in that book that she doesn't always remember correctly. But as Dr. Green says, he prefers her untruth because it radiates health. And that's, I think my mother was talking also for the purposes of health. Whether or not you should tell small children such terrifying tales, I couldn't be sure. But anyway, that went into my understanding. And in the last few years of these grandparents, but in the last few years, being 58 now myself, which is older than he was when I was born, thinking about him again, especially I did this year of psychotherapy, as we all should and must do, and began to think about him quite differently, and understood what he had done for me as a child, which was basically be my guardian angel and reach in and rescue me and bring me west in the car to see the people, the O'Haras as they were, in the west of Ireland, which if he hadn't done, I probably wouldn't have anything to write about.
You wrote May is his wife, and she, in fact, Jack McNulty is the brother-in-law of the Roseanne character that you mentioned.
Yes, he is.
The Secret Scripture.
Yes.
But you wrote you gave May voice in a play in the late 90s.
Our Lady of Sligo.
Did you feel that Jack deserved a right of reply?
I felt I'd been very unfair to Jack. As I say, in that lovely, non-discriminating way of a child, I adored him without reserve as a child. And maybe I got a bit, when I saw the damage, say, done to my mother by that childhood, I mean, just the ordinary, but nevertheless atrocious damage done by being alive in the world, I think she was certainly inclined to blame her father, and I was inclined also just to blindly to follow suit.
He was a very, very heavy drinker and was quite violent.
They both were. No, he was not in any way violent, but they were both heavy drinkers, he and his wife. He has a sentence in this book which I was rather glad when he wrote it down, because it is him in a Accra writing his own account in an effort to get free of himself, really, and to find a personal freedom analogous to the freedom of Ghana that's being created around him. But he says something like, why is it that for some people drinking is like a short-term loan on the spirit, but for others it's a murderous mortgage on the soul? And what he means is that for him, drinking, although he's trying to stop, has been quite different to the experience of his wife. In a bizarre sort of way, it's kept him alive during the war, because three very challenging things happened to him in the war, and if he hadn't been full of whiskey, he probably wouldn't have survived them. Whereas she is also full of gin, but the gin has poisoned her and erased her, his wife, back in Ireland. And he's trying to puzzle that out. And the thing is, for me, about them, maybe writing now about them, is that what I missed before was the reason why they were together. And the fact of the matter is, because somebody was saying today, you know, you could imagine she'd be much better off without this man. But you see, she wouldn't have allowed that, because it's quite obvious to me that what they had was this incredible hunger for each other. They wanted to be with each other. So we may say love is romantic, but love is also an incredible adamantine chain to it, binds one to another, to sometimes to their mutual destruction, which to me was incredibly interesting as a human being of 58. I've been with my wife for 28 years, just to see what this other generation did with the luck of life and the gift of life. And maybe they threw it back, you know, mostly. But it's in the manner, it's in the gesture of throwing back that there's, I found, you know, there's a certain beauty in it.
Why is he a temporary gentleman?
Well, this is the great phrase that was conferred upon in the First World War II, which was for different, they needed officers for different reasons. In the First World War, there was such an attrition rate of officers. You know, you, for a second lieutenant in the front line, you had 7 minutes to survive. So they were always looking for new people. So they brought in people who hadn't been to Sandhurst, for instance, who weren't officer material as such, but might have expertise. And they were given temporary commissions for the duration of the war. And so their nickname was temporary gentlemen. So same in the Second World War. In the book, when the war breaks out, Jack is 37. He's born in 1902, and he gets a temporary commission in the Royal Engineers because he is a very good engineer. So, and he's into bomb disposal then, which was an incredibly dangerous occupation. Also, he's obviously an Irishman doing that, which kind of chimes in with, I think, sort of ambition.
We meet Jack in The Temporary Gentleman in the late 50s. He's writing this memoir,
57,
looking back on his life. What sort of Ghana was he living in at that time? And what was the attraction for you about writing about that? Well, did you just simply have no choice because that's where he was?
Well, I suppose there's no choice in a way, but it was fascinating to me because for a man like Jack, whose own brother, Ennius, has joined the police in before independence and therefore has been given a death sentence to get out of Ireland, and who's being hunted actively.
And who is in your book, The Whereabouts of Ennius McNulty.
Exactly. And, you know, after independence, Father Gaunt becomes very powerful in Ireland. You know, Irish freedom, so long awaited and so, in essence, worth having, nevertheless was a complicated inheritance for some people. So, in a way, he's never really thought about freedom for a country until he's in Ghana as a UN observer. He's in the Gold Coast, and it's becoming free. And, you know, there's something very revelatory in that for him. He's sitting in a bath of freedom. And maybe he's thinking instinctively that maybe he can get something of that freedom for himself, because he knows he should be in Ireland. He knows he should be gone home. He's kind of holed up in this little bungalow out the back of Accra with a lovely man, Tom Quay, who I was delighted to try and write about, a Ghanaian chap who's looking after him and becomes his friend and looks after him.
What role did high life music play in Ghana?
Ah, high life music. Ghana, we now have freedom. Freedom, freedom for Ghana, toils of the brave and sweat of our labours, toils of the brave which have brought results. High life music. This was one of the joys of my research. It was their dance music. I mean, in a way, if you would look for a mutatis mutandis thing here, it would be our kind of country and western music that really is Irish traditional music, if we're being properly honest, because, you know, for the travellers, that's Irish music. And for a lot of country people, that's Irish music, country and western, but that's high life music. And going to the dances and shaking out the leg, all things that Jack understands and admires. Because that's the great empire of dance halls, isn't it? That's the lingua franca of life and the heart, dancing.
The film adaptation of The Secret Scripture, Vanessa Redgrave, due to play...
Talk about dancing.
Yeah, and she's due to play the character of the old Roseanne.
The older Roseanne.
And then Jessica Chastain.
He's playing the younger.
Were you a bit worried about that split for the movie?
No, this is not something I would worry about. Jessica Chastain and Vanessa Redgrave are coming to do your movie. The response is not worry, it's... Yay!
And what
wonderful.
Stage is it at?
Well, May, June filming, last I heard. And maybe Jeremy Irons to play Dr. Green and Reese Mars to play the priest, which is such brilliant casting. Absolutely brilliant.
Are you involved at all in the screenplay for that, or did you just decide
Well,
to
I'm
step
pretending
away?
I am involved. No, the very wonderful Johnny Ferguson wrote the screenplay. He died recently. And as far as I'm concerned, his screenplay is holy writ. And, let's try and honour it.
What happens now? Will you explore family further after the death of your mother? Will you be able to come to that generation
danger,
in the next book?
Danger. I feel danger when you say it, even. Because there is a sort of seventh book that it's when they get married, you know. But I mean, if...
When they being?
My parents. That's to say, there's the three McNulty books and three Dunn books. Now, there's some of those names are obviously changed, but they do join. The reason they're related is because they join. But I mean, if these six books in their own way have been dark books, be the hokey, I don't know. I mean, the trouble is living people, and I don't know what I have a caution against living people, not because I don't think you should do that, but I wonder if they're not actually hiding out in you, you know, if they haven't taken refuge in your DNA, if you are not in some way their heaven or their afterlife, how can you write about them if they're living and breathing? That's why I've always been driven away from writing about the present moment, because they're still there. They're still in charge of their own destinies. Whereas when they're gone, you feel that the stories belong to you. And if they don't, well, you can be a Jesse James and steal them off the freight train.
The current book from Sebastian Barry is The Temporary Gentleman. It's published by Faber and Faber.